I sat there and thought about what a long wait this might turn into, and about the course of things, and looked around again. I noticed a strap sticking out from under the couch Ellen had been sitting on that was made from the kind of tubular webbing that's used for backpacks. I sat the gun on the floor along with the ornament, flipped back the buffalo robe, and moved across the small room to kneel by the sofa. The strap was followed by a grimy day pack. The zipper to the main compartment was broken, but it had been fastened together with large safety pins. I unhooked the pins and had a look inside. Dozens of small glass bottles and a small bundle wrapped in the Durant Current containing close to what looked like about $40,000 in mixed currency. Leo, you bad boy. Whether he would slog his way through a blizzard to the middle fork of Crazy Woman to a trailer and his loopy grandmother was suddenly academic. Leo might leave his grandmother to starve to death, but he would come back for the drugs and the money. I put the bundle back in the knapsack and stuffed the bag under the sofa when I noticed a battered cooler in the kitchen. I wondered what Leo might have put in there. The kitchen reminded me of my grumbling stomach, but my curiosity was stronger than my appetite. If I had been hungry, I wasn't any more. I pulled the aged skull of an adult male from the cooler. I leaned against the counter and held it in my hand. Alas, poor Charlie. The prominent gold tooth was there, central incisor, right. I guess Double Tough hadn't looked at the head. I didn't blame him. You got off easy, you son of a bitch. I carefully placed the skull back in the cooler and walked over to the window where I raised the blind, just far enough to see a fog bank beginning to form along the shadowed canyon wall. The creek water must have been warmer than the air, and if the low cloud cover held, this was going to be a very foggy as well as dark place in about 30 minutes. Now all I had to do was relax and watch what little light there was at the bottom of the windows die. Static.
Unit 1, this is BR-75-115, come in.
The blanket slipped and the ornament fell to the floor, but at least I didn't shoot the door. I had forgotten to turn off the radio. I struggled through the folds in the blanket and pulled it out, the small glow of the channel display providing a comforting light.
Hey, Jess, you got through, over?
Static.
Sheriff, I'm at the base radio at equipment storage. I've got your dog here, and he's been shot.
I stared at the radio, as a million and one things ran through my mind, all of them bad.
Are you sure?
Static.
Yeah, I'm sure. It looks like a small caliber. I'm doing all I can for him.
How did he get there?
Static. He must have drug himself. I went out and followed the blood trail as far as I could, but you can't see a damn thing with all this fog.
I thought about Henry. If Dog was shot. I'm going to need you to call my office. Tell them that I think we've got a man down and that we need all the help we can get. Then get the HPs out here.
Static. Roger that. Out.
Here I sat with every weapon that we had, and my closest friend and blood brother was probably dead out there in the snow somewhere. It was a solid 3 miles back to the methane wells, and that was if I could find him. That's if Leo left him. And what were the chances that Leo would have left him alive? I'm lousy at ignoring first instincts, and mine told me to gather the weapons and head out. I stuffed the little automatic back in my belt, holstered the .45, cocked and locked, along with the mag light, pulled the buffalo robe around me, and flipped the shotgun up on my shoulder. I stuffed the ornament into my duty jacket and started for the door, opened it, and sidestepped. I pulled my hat down tight and raised my head slowly to look into the vaporous white. Barely visible in the fog were blue and red lights that blinked across the blurred canyon walls. My truck. The headlights were shining at an odd angle, and the blue and red ones were simply revolving in place, so I was pretty sure Leo had misjudged the width of the trail and had planted the 3/4 ton over the edge. He was lucky he had done it near the bottom, or the truck would have flipped and killed him. The headlights cast to the left, away from the homestead and the trailer. I stepped down and pulled the door closed quietly behind me. It was only about 150 yards, but the fog made it seem like miles. I started the slow trudge, staying to the right and keeping my one eye on the slightly illuminated portion of the white distance. If he was coming to the trailer, he was going to have to cross that bit of diffused light, and when he did, I would be there. I lowered the Remington from my shoulder and allowed it to swing forward. With all my training, here I was shooting with one eye. There was a movement to my left just out of the headlight beams. I unfocused, as always, allowing my eye to become a motion detector, and waited until whatever it was out there moved again. It did, and it was large. Not only tall, but wide. I stood there, watching as it lumbered into view, in no way the outline of a man. It was at least 4 feet across, and as tall as I am. I was thinking that it was a cow, confused and trying to find some relief from the storm, or a horse trying to do the same. It was a blur in the fog. It swayed there for a moment, and it seemed as though a wing extended outward and then folded back. After a few seconds, the wing extended again and caught a small movement of the air, then flipped sideways only to fall. It shifted its weight, and then both wings caught the breeze, and I was sure the thing would take flight. My mouth fell open, and my mind was jarred to the image of Henry at the busy bee when he had spread the wings on his duster, his battle cry shaking the windows of the cafe. The fog froze the inside of my mouth. Bear? The blast was instantaneous. Leo had been waiting, hoping that I would say something in recognition, and I had. It was as if someone had tied a rope around my leg and tied it to a galloping stallion. I couldn't move. Leg, left, and I thought of bone and the artery as the immediate shock sparked and then subsided. The reason his shadow had been so deformed was that he was carrying Ellen, which meant my shot had to be low. He wasn't expecting a return volley and was probably as surprised as I had been when he pitched backward with the flame of the Remington still in my hands. I fell with the recoil, and the barrel of the shotgun buried itself in the snow and frozen ground below. Useless. I rolled to the left, trying to keep him in view, but all I could see was the freezing fog that reflected in the dimness of the truck's lights. The pain in my leg clinched my guts and pulled my knees forward, even as I tried to negotiate my left arm up for leverage. He was down, too, but I couldn't be sure which of us would be able to get up first. The smart money would be on the man hyped on crystal meth. My hat rolled from my head and rested there in the snow as I looked up. He seemed to be growing from the crusted surface. Henry's coat tried to hold him against the ground for me, and, along with the burden of Ellen Run's horse, did pin him just long enough for me to get the 32 up and out, the 45 still buried at my side. I attempted to time the squeeze on the 32, waiting until a lull in the pain allowed my aim to stay steady long enough to fire off my only round, the chrome pistol extended into the fog. I felt like one of those near-frozen buffalo in imminent danger of being torn apart by a pack of wolves, just waiting for one of those wolves to get close enough. I pulled the trigger, and the little semi-automatic roared and bucked in my hand. The air left his body as the impact of the slug carried his teetering momentum back. Center shot, or close enough. He fell with an angry, gargling sound, and the report of his pistol smacked like a bullwhip. His shot went off harmlessly into the frosted air. I slumped down against my side and breathed again, the cold flood of oxygen inflating my chest as well as causing the searing pain in my thigh to start up again. I took a few more breaths and rolled my head back to look at him. He had collapsed backward on his shattered legs, doubled back as though he'd been playing some perverse game of limbo. I stayed steady, looking at him, and tried to reassemble my mind so that I could begin making assessments on how badly I was hurt, how soon I could reach Ellen Run's horse, and how long it would take me to get us both to cover. Then he moved. It was a feeble gesture at first, almost an involuntary one, but it was a movement nonetheless. I felt my single eye widen as his hand, still holding a very large stainless revolver, scrambled up from the snow like an anti-aircraft battery. A shoulder surged forward as the other arm fought to push him up. Like his grandfather, Leo would not stay in the grave. His head lolled to one side as the trunk of his body approached upright and the arm with the gun dragged across the snow. Our breaths billowed out to join the fog like two locomotives on a collision course. I yanked on the 45 and freed it from the robe, feeling it swing forward, but he was already there, the endless, stainless barrel of a Colt 357 pointed at my face. I felt the surge of cold air in my teeth as I tried to bring the 45 around, but it was too late. There was silence. He had paused for a moment, and all I could think was that this was the last thing I would see. Time froze then, and it was as if the air had died, and the snowflakes just hung there like some ethereal mobile as I looked into the darkness of his face. I waited as he wavered in the silence. The Colt toppled from his hand, and he stood there looking at me before falling forward. A Special Forces Vietnam-issue tomahawk driven deep into the base of his skull. The voice in the distance was garbled, but still discernible.
Nesha nunna wa huisten na koe vine huwe ust e hut me oto.
Tell your ancestors, Standing Bear has sent you. Chapter 16. I was pretty sure that the two of us looked like a human junkyard. We were sitting at the veterinarian's office. Henry struggled out the next sentence with the good side of his mouth.
How's your leg?
It hurts, but only when I walk. It's not so bad when I talk.
He nodded, and we both looked at the carpet.
DCI is going to want to talk to you.
He didn't move, so I continued. How about I go through the story and you can make corrections and additions as we go?
What?
He turned to look at me, and I could see the bulge of the bandage at his jawline.
Just kidding.
So you found the highway patrol cruiser buried in the snow up on the flat? And you stopped the truck and got out to take a look, and the driver didn't move, so you opened the door. I nodded my head for a moment.
What kind of rookie move was that?
He didn't respond, but I could see his jaw flex.
So he raised the glorified 22 and shoots you in the face right off the bat?
I nodded some more. You're lucky it was a 32. The 357 would have deviated your septum. You don't have to answer that.
He didn't.
All right, you fell backward, and then Leo rolls you over, takes you for dead, and strips your coat off of you? Because of this, dog tries to eat Leo alive, and he shoots dog twice and drives off with my truck? I shook my head and looked at the operating room door.
Then you got up, sprinted after the truck, and followed Leo back to the canyon with half your face tied on with a bandana? You ran a half a mile with a subcutaneous bullet trail running from the cleft of your chin to the back of your neck?
He held the bloody fragment of lead that Isaac had pulled out and handed it to me. The door to the operating room was opening, and from the corner of my good eye, I could see Mike Pilch coming out to give us the prognosis on Dog. Mike was a vet who was something of an oddity in Absaroka County, in that he actually tried to save domestic animals as opposed to giving up and putting them down. He stopped short.
Wow, you guys look like eight kinds of hell.
I held a finger to my lips to silence him. We escaped from the hospital. I glanced over at Henry to see him wave a feeble hand at the veterinarian and readjust the leather duster over his knee. The Indian's not talking today. He nodded and studied the bear's face a little more closely. How's Dog? He pulled his eyes away from the spectacle of Henry to look at me. I don't guess the view improved.
It's pretty bad, but he's tough, whatever he is.
He moved over and sat in the chair beside me.
The first bullet just grazed his skull. It was a second bullet that did the most damage, entering the abdomen and lodging in the muscle near the spine. I did an exploratory and found a section of the intestinal tract was perforated and had to remove 11 inches. I flushed the stomach with sterile saline and placed several drains. With the bullet so close to the spine, we'd probably do more harm than good if I tried to take it out. But the body'll wall it off, and it shouldn't cause any future problems. He's still dopey from surgery, but seems to be doing well. I'll need to keep a close watch on him for the next few days. As we left Mike's office, I finished questioning the bear. He was buttoning his leather duster.
Did you put the axe in the base of Leo's skull just to save your coat? He gathered it up as he wearily climbed in the truck.
Wow. I glanced back at the bear. You could have missed. What kind of rookie move was that?
It had been a long night. We had staunched our bleedings and had huddled in the cab of my truck with Ellen Run's horse until Double Tough showed up in a D9 Caterpillar and pulled my 3/4 ton out of the creek bed like it was a flexible flyer. He had rendezvoused with the HPs so that Dahl could be brought to Durant for more professional care, and had drunk about a half a bottle of wild turkey in the meantime, but he seemed as impervious to liquor as he had been to bullets. He pulled us up and out of the canyon, angling the blade so that a slow-motion wall of snow cascaded away from the dozer and cleared a way for us as we were pulled along. By the time we had gotten to the flat above, revolving blue and red lights joined with our own, telling me that the rest of the cavalry had arrived. Vic's unit was the only one that could make it this far. Before we had come to a stop, she was there, yanking the door open and applying a more professional pressure bandage to my leg. Sizer Vittoria helped Henry on the other side of the cab. We left the bear in my truck, thinking it might help maintain the quiet Ellen Run's horse had surrendered to. Sizer Vittoria would drive it to the hospital with them, while I would ride along with Vic. As I leaned against her, she tipped her head around to give me a look. "You get him?" My smile couldn't help but fade. The bear did. I glanced into the truck bed. So did Vic. The half-frozen body of Leo Gaskell was buried into the cradle of snow that had accumulated there. The black alloy tomahawk still stuck up from the back of his head, like a pump lever. She blew a brief breath from pursed lips. "Fuck!" There were 4 HPs parked at the underpass. Wes was dead, only 1 week away from guarding those golf course ponds. They found him where he must have pulled Leo over. He was a veteran cop with more than 35 years on the job, and he had known that Leo was armed and highly dangerous. But something had gone terribly wrong. There was a buzz of activity at the hospital emergency room, one that I had grown used to as of late. Out of the 3 of us, triage speaking, I was 3rd. I waited on a gurney as they stabilized Henry. Bill McDermott had cut off my jeans above the wound, irrigated the hole in my leg, and was now bandaging me up. Ferg leaned against the wall and watched the process. I glanced at him, trying to ignore the pain in my leg. "Katie and Lana?" He smiled. "Christmas shopping over in Sheraton." He shrugged. "They weren't going to stay in that room any longer, and they don't know about all of this." He waited a few moments before asking, "Leo Gaskell dead?" I nodded as we both stared at my leg. "You do it?" "Henry." After a while, he spoke again. "Good." It was a strange remark for the Ferg to make. "Why good?" "He's better at living with it." I felt the dull throb through the anesthetic and wondered where I could get a pair of pants that would fit around the bandage. I looked down at the coroner as he finished. "Does it bother you if I talk to you while you're working?" He smiled. "Most of my patients don't, but go ahead." "How's Ellen Run's horse?" "For a dehydrated old woman who is suffering from exposure and malnutrition, she's doing quite well." There was a nurse at the desk outside the intensive care unit, but she was committing a copy of Red Book to memory, and so only raised her head briefly as we passed. Ellen was in the curtained-off section to the far right, with no one else in the room. They had cleaned her up, and she looked a lot better. I only felt marginally shitty about what we were doing, but when I thought about Marie Baroja, Anna Walksover Ice, and Wes Rogers, I felt better about it. Too many people had died. I dug into my pocket and handed Henry the ornament that I had taken from the tree in her trailer, and her eyes followed it from my hand to his. He held it there between them. The mason jar lid that dangled from the yarn turned slowly, revealing the photo on one side and the name on the other. She stared at me long enough to convince me that I was interfering with the investigative process, so I went to the other side of the curtain. I could hear her whispering. The next thing I knew, Henry was standing next to me. "Anything we can use?" It pained him as he spoke.
"She keeps repeating a phrase that means give up."
"She's throwing in the towel after all this?" He shrugged as I glanced back and saw that she was watching us. I smiled, and to my surprise, she smiled back. She didn't look like somebody who was calling it quits.
She is apologetic about it.
I noticed that he was able to talk softly from the right side of his mouth. She was still holding the mason jar lid. I'm going to need that ornament. He looked back, and she smiled at us some more.
We will have to wait until she is asleep.
Vic had yelled at me last night, and I was thinking there wasn't anybody left to yell at me when I saw Ruby's car. It was a Sunday, but Lucian must not have felt well enough to come to work. Henry quietly closed the door behind us, and I felt like we were sneaking in after an all-night drunk. We stood there on the landing as a set of ferocious blues looked down on us. "How is Dog?" I tried a weak smile. "He's going to be all right. We can visit him in a couple of days." The eyes disappeared. We struggled our way up the steps with Henry assisting by allowing me a hand on his shoulder. My leg was throbbing, so we stopped at the top and I caught my breath. I looked at the bench by the door. Someone was sleeping, covered with one of our Property of Absaroka County Jail wool blankets. The place was like a boarding house. "Who's that?" She didn't look up from the computer screen.
"The methane foreman."
I looked over at Henry, who was risking injury by smiling. "Let's go to my office, shall we?" My chair felt good, and I thought about spending the rest of the day there, but the obligations of duty called my attention to a large tan envelope that read, "Sheriff Sweetie Pie." I had forgotten that she had dropped off an envelope which seemed like an eternity ago. There was a crisp piece of legal paper clipped to a photocopy. I started with the note, a gracefully looping script in red that sprawled across the rigid lines of light blue on yellow. "Mon amour, I've left you a little present I found in one of my investigations of Durant National Bank's safe deposit boxes. The manager found an old registration for box number 283, a Mr. Charles Joseph Nerburn. It hadn't been opened since 1950, but someone had paid the rental fee until around 10 years ago, when the bill came back with addressee unknown." I thought about the timing, and that was when Lucian had taken up residence at the Durant home for assisted living. I guess he had forgotten about the rental. I looked up at Henry, but he was looking out the window, so I continued reading to myself. "I'm here for another day and a half, but then I've got to be in Denver on the 24th at 9 a.m. Call me." I looked up at the old Seth Thomas clock, figuring maybe I could just catch up with her and convince her to stay another day, but then wondered how Katie would feel about that. I hadn't seen her in almost 2 days, and she'd be gone before I knew it. I flipped the note over and looked at the photocopy. It was Charlie Nerburn's will and testament, or a copy thereof. It was pretty cut and dried, and left all Charlie's assets to Joseph Walks Over Ice. Joseph. We had a name. I handed the copy to Henry and called for Ruby. Even with the limp, I met her at the door. "Get the NCIC and ask about a Joseph Walks Over Ice. Male, about 55 years of age, born in Sheridan County. See if anything pops up." She disappeared around the corner as I turned back to the bear. "Ring any bells?" He shook his head as I went around the desk and sat back down. "I've got an idea." His eyes stayed steady with mine. I stared at the surface of my desk. "Whoever killed Marie Barogia did it to get her money. Since illegitimate or stepchildren cannot inherit directly, the only way to do that was to have Marie predecease Charlie so that he could collect his elective share. Then you kill off the already dead Charlie and inherit the money he left you." The bear's eyes widened, and I continued. "Leo Gaskell, and more importantly, Joseph Walks Over Ice, found it suddenly financially beneficial to keep Lucian's ruse going after the methane started producing. I think it snowballed on them. I don't think they thought that that many people knew Charlie was dead. Even Lana would have to be on the list. She told me that Lucian had killed her grandfather the day I met her. Everyone who knew Charlie was dead had been either attacked or killed. I slumped back in my chair and yelled into the other room. "Have you got anything?" The reply was curt.
"Hold your horses."
"There's something else that's bothering me." Henry handed me back the will, and I laid the photocopy on the desk. "I'm sure they killed Anna because she was trying to tell Doc Bloomfield about Leo's plans or Joseph's. But how did Leo kill Wes Rogers?" It was quiet in the room. Wes would have known. Unless Leo Gaskell was not driving the car. Ruby's voice called from the other room.
"I've got something."
We rushed in, as best we could, and crowded around the computer screen as Ruby summoned forth Joseph Walks Over Ice. The name came up in the Department of Child Services in Cheyenne. A child was given up for adoption to a Catholic orphanage of St. Anthony's in Casper back in 1951. Henry and I locked eyes. It wasn't that Ellen was giving up. It was what she had given up. What else? The child had numerous altercations and was described as emotionally disturbed. He was never adopted and left the orphanage at age 16. She looked up at me. "That's as far as it goes." Henry spoke softly through his bandage.
"At that period in time, a lot of Indian children took the surname of the priest who ran the orphanage."
Ruby's fingers started dancing again. She turned to me. "The priest who signed off on Joseph's papers was a Father Mark Leskey."
Leskey. Joseph. Joe Leskey.
I grabbed the phone from Ruby's desk and punched in the number for the home. Jennifer Felsen answered, and I asked her if Joe was on duty.
"He was here a little while ago, but he got off at 8 o'clock. Is there a problem?"
"Is he still around?"
"I'll check."
I stood there with the phone in my hand.
"Shelley saw Joe walk out of here with Lucian about 20 minutes ago."
"If they show up, call me. Thanks, Jennifer." I hung up and looked at Henry. Double Tough had woken up with all the commotion and was now standing with us. He has been everywhere in this case. I looked down at Ruby.
"Where are Vic and Sizer Pretoria?"
She stuttered. "There was a fender bender on the highway bypass.
Radio them and get them in here now. Joe Leskey's out with Lucian." I took a deep breath, trying to clear my head.
Where would they go?
I took another breath and thought out loud.
Where would Joe take him?
It was the clearest I'd heard him speak since he'd been shot.
Breakfast?
I turned to Ruby on her way out. "Tell Vic and Sizer Pretoria to meet us at the B." As we started down the steps, I noticed that the methane foreman was accompanying us. I turned my head toward him so that I could see him with my uncovered eye.
"Where the hell do you think you're going?"
He smiled as he caught the door and allowed Henry to go through first.
"I thought you might need somebody who could both walk and talk."
He had a point. We pulled up alongside the busy bee, just as Vic's unit slid to a stop beside us, only missing the front of my truck by inches. Her window was rolled down.
"Joe fucking Leskey?"
The place was packed as we fluttered in, all the patrons freezing at the sight of an armed sheriff, two deputies, an Indian, and a construction worker. We probably looked like the village people. I caught Dorothy's eye from behind the counter.
"Lucian and Joe Leskey?"
You couldn't ruffle her feathers with a brick.
"Haven't seen them."
We regrouped on the sidewalk, and I started breaking it down. "Vic, you and Double Tough, go to the home and wait. If they show up, just tell Joe that we've got some papers for him at the office. Try not to tip him off, but bring him in no matter what." They left in Vic's unit as I turned to Sizer Pretoria.
"Santiago, get Ferg and do a perimeter. Radio the HPs and tell them to stop anything heading south on I-25 and that we're looking for Lucian and Joe Leskey."
I tossed him the keys to the bullet and he was gone. I turned to look down Main Street and then back at the bear. I thought for a long moment. "I've got a question for you." He didn't say anything. "What makes us think that Joe took Lucian?" I looked back down the street at the Euskadi Hotel sign. "What if Lucian took Joe?"
"Morning, Lucian."
"Joe." I limped the 20 feet to the table. Lucian was facing me as I came in, the old gunfighter to the end. Joe had his back to the door, but turned and lightly smiled as I entered. There were 2 cups of coffee on the table, but it looked like Joe was the only one drinking. Lucian's hat was off and placed on the chair beside him with the brim down, which struck me as strange. The old sheriff looked relaxed, leaning back in his chair with his hands folded in his lap. Joe had his elbows resting on the table. Neither of them had their coats on. Both were hanging from their chairs, and the jukebox was playing Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanians Ring Those Christmas Bells. I hobbled past them to the bar back and poured myself a cup of coffee and gently placed it on a saucer. Coffee bought 10 minutes. I raised a cup to Henry, who had stayed back by the door. He shook his head no. As I stalled at the bar, trying to think how I was going to play this, I thought of the mixture of excitements the next few minutes could unleash. "What happened to your leg?" Joe was looking at me, but he was also glancing at Henry and his bandaged face. "And what happened to you?" I shuffled back over to their table, turned one of the bentwood chairs around, and sat, giving me ready access to my sidearm and Joe. "Oh, we got shot." They were both staring at us now. Lucian, the first to ask, "Who the hell shot you?" I studied the little vase on our table with its decorative plastic sprigs of holly and mistletoe, then trailed an arm over the back of the chair and took a sip of my coffee, my sore hand hardly fitting the delicate dinnerware of the Euskadi. "Leo Gaskell?" I kept my eyes on the old sheriff. "We've got him up at the hospital, and they're patching him up." Another Lazarus on the pile. It was quiet for a moment, but then the music swelled with the false vibrancy and good humor of the season. "Who's Leo Gaskell?" I turned and looked at Joe Lesky. You had to give him credit. He was good. Drug dealer from over in Fremont County. Looks like he's the one that hurt Anna Walks Over Ice. May as well keep everybody alive. He's up there talking to the investigators now. Joe's head nodded. He, too, was trying to buy time, but in an establishment where nobody was selling. "Well, it's good you got the guy that did it." "Yep." The old sheriff was watching me very closely as I turned back to him and tried to get a read. "What are you up to?"
"Doing some Christmas shopping."
"The stores aren't open yet." He looked back at Joe.
"I got plenty of time."
He adjusted his hat on the seat of the chair beside him. Now I knew where the gun was. Joe started to push off from the table.